Well, if you've got a Bible, keep it open on that passage, and we'll be referring to it later. We're doing a little mini series of 3 weeks in Mark's Gospel in chapter 4 and 5, and there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that we thought that 8 weeks of the book of Revelation was about as much as one church could handle, and so we're just taking a little pause and getting something a bit easier and more familiar for 3 weeks, and then we've got Easter, and then we're coming back to Revelation, and we'll do 8 more weeks and finish the whole book. So it's just a bit of a change of scenery for a bit. But also, we thought in times of COVID that anxiety has been a really big issue. People in the church, people outside the church, everyone is very worried. Everyone's very fearful. And it would be great to delve into the Bible and see what it has to say about that and what kind of help and antidote there is in the scriptures for that. And these sections of Mark's Gospel, chapter 4 and chapter 5, there's 4 episodes. We're doing them in 3 weeks. So 1 episode this week, and the next one next week, and then 2 in the final week. They're all about the issue of fear and anxiety. I've put on the handout as an introduction, what do you do with your fear? Because fear is everywhere. I looked up on the website of Anxiety UK, which is a mental health charity, for some statistics. And it told me that in 2013, that's not very recently, I realise, but that's the latest time this kind of survey was done. In 2013, there were 8.2 million cases of anxiety disorder in the UK. And as far as I can work out, 2013 was not a particularly stressful year. It's just sort of a normal year. And this year, obviously, has been a much more stressful year. And I haven't got stats on the number of people with clinical anxiety disorder, but I have got the results of a questionnaire by the Office of National Statistics, which admittedly, they're asking very scary questions. So they're the kind of questions that are going to make you stressed, just if you were asked this. But this is what they asked people last April, just at the beginning of the first lockdown. How anxious are you about reduced income? People scored 6 out of 10 for anxiety. How worried are you about the use of your savings being used up just trying to make ends meet? 4 out of 10. How worried are you about having to work at the same time as childcare and juggling the two? 6 out of 10. How worried are you about struggling to pay bills? 7 out of 10. I mean, this has been a stressful year. People are anxious, sometimes clinically anxious. Sometimes people experience anxiety attacks where your heart starts racing, your breathing becomes heavy, and you panic, and it's an involuntary thing and you can't kind of control it, and it's very, very distressing. And many people, I guess, will have experienced that. Or then other people have phobias that just get really out of control. Arachnophobia. I like to tell people I don't have arachnophobia in England. But in Australia, I do, because I think in Australia, it's quite rational to be scared of spiders. But claustrophobia, my mother suffered from it when we were growing up. So we never, ever took the lift. We used to climb a lot of stairs. I think we were quite fit children. You know, we climb all the stairs of the shopping centre just because mum was terrified of small spaces. Phobias or panic attacks. But for lots of people, I guess it's not actually sort of clinical level anxiety. It's just worry. Just baseline worry, the kind of thing that when you're in bed goes over you in your mind, and in some cases it stopped people sleeping. Now, providentially, after we decided to do this series on fear, Andrew said to me, oh, have you come across the latest book by Mike Reeves? And I hadn't done, but this was last week, and I now have. I bought it and I've read the whole thing. Rejoice and Tremble. It's called The Surprising Good News About the Fear of the Lord. And it's an excellent book. In fact, it's so excellent that I've been tempted to include lots of it in today's sermon. Although, of all the passages in the Bible he covers, he doesn't actually cover Mark chapter 4. So you can be reassured this is not wholesale plagiarism. But it is extremely good. And it might be that you want to get hold of it as part of this next series or as some Easter reading. It's excellent. It actually comes in 2 forms. This is the sort of meaty one. And then there's a light one as well, which is shorter and lighter, which is just called What Does It Mean to Fear the Lord? To be honest, the supposedly heavy one isn't very heavy, so you might want to get this one. But anyway, it's a really good book. And I thought I would just quote from him as he gives a little survey of the problem of fear in our culture. And he says this: our private daily routines are filled with still more sources of anxiety. Take our diet, for example. If you choose the full fat version on the menu, you're headed for a heart attack. Yet we're regularly confronted with the latest discovery that the low calorie alternative is actually carcinogenic or harmful in some other way. And so a low grade fear starts with breakfast. Or think of the paranoia surrounding parenting today. The valid, but usually overblown, fear of the kidnapper lurking online or outside every school has helped fuel the rise of helicopter parenting and children more and more fenced in to keep them safe. Small surprise then that universities are now expected to provide previously unheard of, quote unquote, safe spaces to protect students. Children have grown up so protected that they're not expected to be able to cope with opposing viewpoints or criticism. It's just one indicator that they're considered more fragile than students were a generation ago. However, it's wrong to single out the pejoratively named Generation Snowflake. As a whole, we are increasingly anxious and an uncertain culture. Although that's perceptive, it's just everywhere. It's in breakfast, it's in parenting, it's in universities, it's everywhere. We are anxious. And my question is, what do you do with that? I take it lots of people at Grace Church Greenwich are anxious, and lots of people tuning in now on Zoom or Facebook are anxious. All of us face this, or many of us face this. But what do you do with it? And there are all sorts of things that you could try, and some of them are very sensible. If it's really out of control anxiety, you might go to the doctor, and that would be a very good idea. In fact, I've been to the doctor for that reason some years ago now, and it was a great help. It might be that you do need medication if the brain chemistry has got a bit out of kilter, and you might need that kind of help. But if it's less serious than that, if it's sort of subclinical anxiety, maybe you might try, well, the buzz one at the moment is mindfulness. Again, lots of it's common sense, you know, just take some time out and breathe a bit slower and give yourself some space and think about something else other than the thing that worries you. What do you do when you're fearful? Well, the great news is that the Bible has an antidote to anxiety. And these chapters of Mark's Gospel, chapter 4 and 5, are all about it. And we're going to find, I hope, some theologically powerful, but also some really practical advice to help us when we are stressed. And you'll see this episode, you'll have noticed, they are very frightened and they're going to die in a storm. It's quite a frightening thing. And Jesus says, why are you so afraid? Have you no faith? In the next episode, Jesus exorcises 2,000 demons from a man in the grip of evil. And we're told that he is fully recovered. But chapter 5, verse 15, they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind. And they were afraid. People are afraid at the transformation, the power that Jesus has over evil. Then in the next episode, Jesus heals a woman. Actually, she just touches him and she's healed. And we're told in chapter 5, verse 33, the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him. And then the last one of all, and maybe this is the most terrifying thing of all, a father whose daughter is very sick, and who dies. And Jesus says to the ruler of the synagogue, this man with a daughter who's just died, he says, don't fear, only believe. So these are four situations that are really very frightening. Here, a life-threatening storm. The next one, real evil. Jesus comes face to face with real evil. The next one, a woman who's been ill for 12 years. The final one, the death of a child. I mean, these are terrifying situations. And in each case, Jesus has something to do to say to our fear. And I hope we're going to find it really practical and really helpful. So let me share our first heading. In a real physical historical storm, it made a difference to have Jesus around. in a real historical physical storm, it made a difference to have Jesus around. And these are the first five verses of our passage. On that day, when evening had come, Jesus said to his disciples, "Let's go across to the other side." Now, this is pretty normal because two of Jesus' disciples, James and John, are fishermen. And so they're often taking little boat trips with Jesus. And in particular, boat trips are handy because, I mean, I guess it's nice in the evening to go out on the sea. But also, it's an efficient way of traveling around Galilee rather than walking all the way around the outside of the lake. You just nip across the lake in a boat. But it's also a very efficient way of getting away from massive crowds. And Jesus' teaching attracted huge crowds. He'd often just hop into the boat and to get away from them at the end of a day's teaching. So that's so far so normal for Jesus. But unusually, abnormally, this time there is a terrible storm, verse 37. A great windstorm arose and the waves were breaking into the boat, so the boat was already filling. I actually experienced something a little bit like this. I've been to Israel three times, been privileged to go. And one of those times we went, actually it wasn't the Sea of Galilee up in the north, it was the Dead Sea down in the south. But I witnessed just how dramatic and violent Middle Eastern weather can be. We were at the Dead Sea, which, as you know, is quite a tourist. It's a tourist spot, not just for people interested in the Bible. It's a tourist spot because obviously you can float in it, which is quite fun. But also, apparently, Dead Sea mud is extremely good for your complexion, and people are sort of covering themselves with mud. And there's all these cosmetic shops and there's cafes and stuff. And it's very, very hot there. It's in the desert, and so there are lots of bars with kind of picnic umbrellas that you can shelter under to keep the sun off you. And we were there. Deserved my mum actually, and there was a massive storm suddenly came out of nowhere, and it whipped up and it started lifting these picnic umbrellas into the air, into the sky, and they, you know, they had poles on them, and then they started falling with like daggers, and everyone was panicking and screaming, getting out of the way, and it was very, very dramatic. And I thought, you know, it's pretty scary to be on the beach when that happened. You would not want to have been in a boat. And this was a bad storm. So bad that the people in the boat think that they are going to perish. "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" Now, this isn't Andy Satch out in Cornwall on a dinghy being terrified of a slight gust. These are fishermen. You know, they go out on the sea every day. But suddenly they know when things have got out of control and the storm is really, really bad news. It's a very serious storm, but actually they needn't have been scared because they've got Jesus with them. And I love the contrast. Did you notice the contrast? If you were to assess the anxiety of people on this boat, you know, there are 12 very, very worried people, the disciples. And then there is one person who is so not worried that he is fast asleep. And you can even play a game of Odd One Out as you try to sort of paint the mental picture in your mind. Let me read it to you. Great windstorm, waves breaking into boat filling, asleep on cushion. It's hard even to construct it, isn't it? How could you have, I mean, like soft furnishings at the same time as this crazy maritime scene of disaster? And everyone panicking and Jesus sleeping. And you may know the famous and rather amazing picture by Rembrandt of it. Here it is. I love this picture. You know, you can see the drama. Look at the angle that the mast is at. Look at the waves sort of crashing over and people are holding on, trying desperately to not to be thrown overboard, clinging desperately to the mast. And then you pan over and then here's Jesus. I love how he's painted him. He looks really sleepy. He's just been woken up. And they're obviously shaking him awake by the shoulder. And when Jesus wakes up, he just turns to the sea and says, "Quiet, be still." You know, the same thing that I try with my dog. And it, you know, it only works 5 times out of 10 with the dog. But with Jesus, it works with the sea. And everything is suddenly okay. And everyone is saved. Now, I've said here, in a real physical, historical storm, it made the difference to have Jesus around. And that's important because it is possible to read this passage And to take it in a kind of metaphorical way, there's a famous verse in the Psalms that where God says, "Be still and know that I am God," which obviously is a wonderful verse. It's in God's word, but it could be a kind of soppy, sentimental verse. You can imagine saying to somebody, "Oh, don't worry, be still, just be still and peaceful and know that I'm God." But I want to warn us against just jumping immediately to the psychological. You know, we end up asking things like, well, in the quote unquote storms of your life, where do you turn? Because Jesus can help you with the storms of life. Well, that may be true, but if this is only a metaphor, it doesn't actually have much to say to us at the end of the day. Just a sort of wishful thinking. I guess a lot of people think that is what the Bible's like, just a sort of mental trick where you can persuade yourself to think happy thoughts about things. You know, just imagine the calming power of Jesus. Some of you know that I have a link with Latvia and have been several times to do stuff in partnership with the church there. And one of my friends in Latvia, I think it's fair to say, if he wasn't a Christian pastor, he would probably be running the Latvian mafia. He's a real character. And he's a stocky guy, he wears a leather jacket, he's very, very shrewd. And in fact, before he became a Christian, he got a job as a church pastor because he thought it was an excellent business opportunity. So what was happening, genuinely, he wasn't converted, but he thought, there's money in this. Because in Latvia, after the fall of communism, people were flocking back to church because people just wanted to connect with everything that hadn't been allowed under the communists, including church. So people were going to church and he thought, you know, there's money to be made in this. So he went to register as a pastor. And for some years he worked as a pastor of a church without being a Christian. And he used to have sex with his girlfriend on Saturday night and then go and preach on Sunday morning. And he smoked, I think I said this morning it was a pipe, but actually it was a cigar, I think. And he used to smoke cigars. And he said that he got really stuck one day when he had to preach on the feeding of the 5,000 because he couldn't work out how Jesus had done it. He said he had to smoke a lot of cigars that night and he was really puzzled. And then he read this commentary by a sort of skeptic that said what it was that Jesus' personality was so powerful that even though people were hungry, they felt full and they just had a sense of being satisfied when they were with him because of the psychodrama. And he thought, oh, this is great, excellent. He was really chuffed that he'd found his answer. And so the next day in church, he sort of preached on the feeding of the 5,000 and how it was just a psychological thing and people felt full. And there was an old lady in the congregation who was deaf and she hadn't heard a word of the sermon. But as she was leaving, she shook his hand and said, "Thank you so much for the sermon, Vicar. Because, you know, God was so good to us in the gulags." This woman had been in a basically concentration camp under the Soviets as a Christian who trusted her God. She didn't think it was a metaphor. You know, she thought that Jesus actually had miraculous power and had really fed 5,000 people. And that hope of the power of Jesus had got her through unimaginable suffering. And because she hadn't heard the sermon, she congratulated the vicar thinking he'd said the same. And he said he felt so wretched that he was just trying to be clever in a sermon and met a woman who had real faith in the face of terrible adversity. And actually, that was one of the things that led him towards being converted himself. He felt so awful that he sought God for forgiveness for that. But the feeding of 5,000 wasn't a metaphor, and this storm isn't a metaphor, because if all we've got to offer people is metaphor, then we really have nothing to offer them. It matters that this actually happened. On the 6th of March 1987, the roll-on, roll-off passenger and freight ferry Herald of Free Enterprise, under the command of Captain David Lurie, sailed from the number 12 berth in the inner harbour of Zeebrugge at 18:05 Greenwich Mean Time. The Herald was manned by a crew of 80 hands all told and was laden with 81 cars, 47 freight vehicles and 3 other vehicles. Approximately 459 passengers had embarked for the voyage to Dover, which they expected to be completed without incident in the prevailing good weather. There was a light easterly breeze and very little swell. The Herald passed the outer mole at 18:24. She capsized about 4 minutes later. Water rapidly filled the ship below the surface level, with the result that not less than 150 passengers and 38 members of the crew lost their lives. And if you remember that, the Herald of Free Enterprise, I remember I was 11 years old. It was on the news on every channel for ages. The worst maritime disaster since the sinking of the Titanic. It was a real ship that really wasn't that really sunk, because it really filled with water. And this boat in Mark chapter 4 is no less real than that. It's historical, it's actual. And the difference was that in this case, there was an actual, physical, real miracle. It matters that this is not just psychology, it's an actual event. Because if all we've got to offer people is warm feelings, we have nothing, actually. You know, wouldn't it be nice to imagine life after the death, after death? Wouldn't it be nice to imagine a God who can still the storms of anxiety in your life? No, not really. That would just be imagination, and it would be empty. But this is a God who really walked on the earth, who really got into a boat. There was really a storm, and with a word, he stilled it. Jesus has enormous power, and they witnessed that. But having seen that it's real and physical and historical, we can then make the other point, and I think it is valid if it rides on the back of the real historical one. In metaphorical storms, it really does make a difference to have Jesus around, but the evidence for that is what he did in the real physical storm. So I think you now can say Psalm 46 verse 10 and say, look, in chaos and turmoil, be still and know that I am God. And isn't it great that Mark chooses to narrate the most serious ones? I'm sure Jesus was helpful when people were worried about smaller things. You know, I'm a bit worried about tomorrow's, where the meal's going to come from tomorrow. In fact, Jesus addresses that in the Sermon on the Mount. Don't worry about what you'll eat or drink. Or I'm a bit worried about what I'm going to wear this winter because I haven't got many clothes. No, don't worry about what you'll wear. So Jesus does talk about the everyday things, the mundane things, the stress about your children's education, the stress about being ill from COVID, the stress about a relationship at work that's not going very well. I mean, Jesus isn't above talking about those nitty gritty things, but I think it's helpful that here in Mark, we get the really extreme things. Because even when you're about to die, even when you're in the grip of terrible evil in the next chapter, even when your daughter is on the point of death the week after, Jesus can help in those situations. If you can help in the big things, he can help in the small things. It really makes a difference to have Jesus around. In fact, if it doesn't make a Jesus difference, then Jesus thinks something's wrong. He says to the disciples, why are you so afraid? Have you no faith? It ought to make a difference to know the God of incredible power. Now, that's not just to add a guilt trip to people who already feel worried. I mean, as I say, I've been to the doctor with anxiety in the past. It's not this is sort of sub-Christian to struggle with it. But Jesus does say that we need help from God to trust him in that situation. I mean, people have been very frightened, haven't they, by COVID. I mean, maybe in some cases rightly, but in lots of cases not rightly, or at least excessively. I think people's anxiety over it have exceeded, in some cases, you know, people who are healthy and fine have been gripped by fear. Now, you've got to be sensible. I mean, it's right that we're cautious. But Christians ought not respond in the same terror, because it makes a difference to know that Jesus is with you in the face of life and death, even. Here are some words, again, quoted in Mike Reeves, from the Puritan writer John Flavel. And he wrote a book called A Practical Treatise on Fear. This is a great Puritan title. It's very down to earth, isn't it? And he says this: if men would but dig to the root of their fears, they would certainly find unbelief there. Jesus says in Matthew, why are you afraid, O you of little faith? The less faith, still the more fear. Fear is generated by unbelief, and unbelief is strengthened by fear. And therefore, all the skill in the world can never cure us of the disease of fear, till God first cure us of our unbelief. Christ therefore took the right method to rid his disciples of their fear, rebuking their unbelief. It should make a difference to us to have Jesus around. But the question is, well, how does it make a difference, right? Okay, so I know that in theory, and I know that God loves me, and I know that Jesus is powerful, but I'm still worried. Well, I love this about the passage, that it goes further in helping us to know actually what to do then with our fear. And that takes us to our third and final point. Do a fear swap. Fear Jesus instead of whatever else you're scared of. Do a fear swap. Fear Jesus instead of whatever else you're scared of. Because just to tell an anxious person, stop worrying, actually does not help. And maybe you know that because you've tried it, or maybe you know it because you've been the recipient of it. You know, you're really worried about something and people just tell you not to worry, and it does not stop you worrying. But it's almost like, well, I think it is like Jesus knows that. He knows we can't stop worrying because we have a kind of built-in need to be anxious about things or to be intimidated by something. So Jesus' solution is much more practical. He says, well, just change what you're worried about. Why don't you fill up all of your fear capacity with the fear of God rather than a fear of the other thing? And that's what happens in this passage. I don't know if you noticed. It's very strange. If you were to map it out on a timeline or a storyboard, as if you're about to make a film of it, just imagine. So scene one, let's go across the lake in the boat, shall we, says Jesus. Okay, so they all go get into the boat, perfectly normal day. Scene two, terrible storm, everyone's about to die. Scene three, Jesus has calmed the storm and it's all fine. Okay, which scenes would you expect to be the frightening scenes? Scene two, I mean, the one where they're going to die. I mean, that is quite frightening. Not scene three, I don't think. Not the scene where everything's okay. I would expect relief, but not fear. But look at what happens in the passage. Verse 40, Jesus said, why are you so afraid? What was the problem? Why were you so worried? Do you have no faith? And then, verse 41, the wind having ceased, the sea being calm, then they were filled with great fear and said to one another, who then is this that even wind and sea obey him? You see, they're not worried about dying anymore. But they're now very fearful. They're trembling at the thought of who is in the boat with them. God himself, the creator of the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that's in it. And that's right, actually. That is the right response, the fear swap. In fact, we see it all over the Bible. And we see it in Jonah. And we heard this in our first reading, that verse 5, the mariners were afraid and each cried out to his God. They're afraid in verse 5 because they're going to die. It's the same as in Mark. There's a terrible storm. These experienced fishermen think they're going to die. And they all call out to whatever God they can think of. They're pagans. They all worship different gods. They're afraid. But by the end of the passage, when the sea is absolutely calm and it's all fine and no one's going to die, then they are very, very afraid. But not now of all their own different gods. They're now afraid of the Lord, of Yahweh, the true God, because they suddenly discovered that the true God has the power over the sea, and they tremble before him. That's a good thing. And actually, Mark uses exactly the words from Jonah 1:16. He basically quotes it. He reuses the Jonah story in the way that he tells the episode of Jesus. The men were exceedingly afraid of the Lord, says Jonah, of Jesus, says Mark, Jesus, the one who is God. And that is right. That is the right swap. Because now the thing that they're worrying about is not, are we going to die or not? But are we going to please God or not? Is he happy with us or not? Now, somebody messaged me. I preached this morning, as you know, in the morning service. And someone sent me a message afterwards, which is very helpful. And I asked if I could read it out sort of anonymously. So he said something that you could change for the afternoon's sermon. So I've heard it and I'm going to change it by reading out this message. He says, it seems counterintuitive to opt to fear something else as an antidote to fearing, especially when the thing to fear is more scary than the thing you were previously fearing. On the face of it, it sounds like you could make your anxiety worse. That's a great question, isn't it? So I'm saying the antidote to being afraid is to be afraid of God. And you might think, well, what use is that? Because you're just making me more scared. And in fact, this is a great chance to add a little atheist quote. And we actually, Andrew quoted from this guy a couple of weeks ago, I think, Bertrand Russell, the British philosopher, in his book, Why I'm Not a Christian. And here's another little section of it. Religion is based, he says, I think, primarily and mainly on fear. It's partly the terror of the unknown. Fear is the basis of the whole thing. Fear of the mysterious, fear of defeat, fear of death. Fear is the parent of cruelty. Therefore, it's no wonder if cruelty and religion has gone hand in hand. So that's Bertrand Russell's take on it. That what is the use of making people scared of God? But I think Bertrand Russell hasn't understood what the Bible understands. That we're actually anxious in our culture because we're not scared of God. In other words, you're most afraid of the thing that you think can have most effect on your life. I'm scared of COVID because COVID could wreck my life. I'm scared of getting the sack because getting the sack at work could destroy my life. I'm scared of a relationship because that relationship is crucial to my life. And because the atheist only has those things, it gets totally out of control. And the Bible says, no, instead, have something who can affect, or have someone who can affect your life much more than any of those things. Have a God who is so powerful that he controls the sea, that he can still a storm just like that, that he decides when every one of us lives or dies. He decides our future and the future of our children. Everything is in his hands. And be intimidated by him. But of course, the great thing is that for the Christian, the one that we're fearful of is then also the one who loves us and who we know is good. So I'm not afraid of an impersonal virus. I'm not afraid of an unpredictable boss. I'm not afraid of a very rocky relationship. I'm afraid of an absolutely consistently good and loving Heavenly Father. The one who can most affect my life is also one I can trust, who's for me. And so you're swapping a fear of chaotic things with a fear of an absolutely right and trustworthy one. We see it in Jonah, we see it in Mark. I'll give you a couple other examples. Here's Psalm 34. Psalm 34, I call it the fear psalm. It's written by David when he was in a very frightening situation. He was on the run from Saul, who was trying to kill him. And while hiding from Saul, he went into the Philistine territory of Gath in disguise. And then he gets found out. This is pretty frightening, right? So he's on the run and his cover is blown. And he's very frightened. And then afterwards, he looks back on the situation and it turns out God saved him. And he says this, I sought the Lord. He answered me and he delivered me from all my fears. But then what you don't expect him to go on to say is, so let me tell you, everyone, this is my advice to you all. Come, O children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. He says, God saved me from being scared of things. So my advice to everybody is that you're scared of God. Do a fear swap. Fear the Lord and you won't be afraid of anything else. And then another one from Isaiah. Don't fear what they fear, what other people in the world fear. Don't be in dread. But the Lord of hosts, him you shall regard as holy, let him be your fear and let him be your dread. It's almost the definition of a Christian. I don't fear other things, I fear God instead. Don't fear what they fear. Let him be your fear. Let God be your fear. And then it comes up in 1 Peter. We saw it in our small group Bible studies a while ago. Fear God, says Peter in chapter 2, and a little bit later on, do not fear anything else that is frightening. It's the fear swap. And I want us to practice doing it. Because this is meant to be very, very practical. When you feel anxiety, maybe it's in bed, you're lying awake, your things are going over and over in your head. Maybe it's something that is a sort of anxiety you have that you know has got a bit out of control. And as I say, please don't hear this as you'll never need to go to the doctor. It may be, if it's really out of control, go and see your GP. That's a good idea. But for the Christian, alongside a visit to the GP, practice the fear swap. So what you've got to do is make Jesus in your mind bigger than the thing that you're scared about. So think, how much control does this have over my future, this thing? Compare, how much control does Jesus have over my future? How much is this able to kill me? I mean, go to the extreme. How much is this able to kill me, this thing? You know, losing your job won't kill you, but how much is Jesus able to kill me? I know it sounds macabre, but Jesus actually recommends exactly that comparison. Don't fear people who can kill you. Fear God who can kill you and punish you. And then think, but he won't punish me because he's good. The one I'm more afraid of, the one who can control my life more than this, the one who can kill me more than this, he's actually good. He's my Heavenly Father. He loves me. I'm safe in his hands. Maybe think about this episode in Mark's Gospel and remind yourself this is an actual, real, physical, historical storm. And they were scared. And Jesus says, why are you scared? Do you not trust me? No, you know that I'm for you and I'm with you and I'm looking out for you. I guess for some of you, it's a concern for your children. Sometimes we worry for the wrong things for our children. You know, like, will my child be have an enormously successful career in the world's eyes? And that's probably not that important. But the thing that you should worry about for your children is, like, will my child trust Jesus and be safe in him? Will they go on to eternity with him? Well, trust Jesus for that. He's in charge of that. And we're scared of our health, maybe. You know, am I going to get better? Am I going to die? Will I be disabled for a long time? Will this cripple me? Well, Jesus is in charge of that. So trust him for that. And have a way of increasing the magnitude of the fear of Jesus and the extent to which he has a control over you, and use that to displace the other thing that has a control over you, the fear swap. We're going to take a moment's pause, and I'm suggesting that we reflect on the same thing in coffee questions afterwards. How do we encourage each other to fear Jesus more, to fear the Lord more? How will that be an antidote? But maybe just take a moment just to do that right now. Maybe a prayer in your heart quietly. And then after a few moments pause, we're going to continue in prayer together.